tribes are still sovereign nations within the United States. You know, some tribes, like my husband is Iroquois, and his people, his nation, they issue their own passports and they travel under them.
Listen,
the Iroquois Nationals, the lacrosse team, travels internationally as a team with passports from their nation.
We got it. We're out of time, Jacqueline.
Okay.
We could just keep going for hours, and we'll be back in a month, and if not before. So thank you so much, Jacqueline Keeler.
Thanks.
And this has been Wednesday Talk Radio with your host, Paul Rowland. Stay tuned for more great programming here on KBOO Community Radio.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
The World Arts Foundation Incorporated and KBOO would like to invite you to its 32nd annual tribute to the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on Monday, January the 16th, from 11 a.m. until 6 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center, located at 7600 Northeast Gleason. Invited guests will include a multitude of speakers and performances that includes the Portland Interfaith Gospel Choir and choirs from the Portland Public Schools, African drumming, and the acclaimed Jefferson Dancers, and much, much more. Monday, January the 16th, from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., live right here on KBOO 90.7 FM. Keep alive the dream.
The greatness of America is the right to protest far right.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 34th Annual Real Music Film Series taking place January 13th through February 5th at the Northwest Film Center. New works and classics are featured this year, including The Jazz Loft According to W. Eugene Smith, Mose Allison, Ever Since I Stole the Blues, How Sweet the Sound, The Blind Boys of Alabama, the Les Blank film about Leon Russell called A Poem is a Naked Person, and many, many more. Again, that's the 34th Annual Real Music Film Series taking place January 13th through February 5th. All screenings take place in the Witzel Auditorium in the Portland Art Museum, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 9:01. And coming up next, Project Censored calls for a mass uprising to stop the Trump regime before it starts.
We want to smash, crash, blast, smash, blast the system. We want to get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud. This pumping rhythm is hitting. We want to make it clear. We ain't scared. This is the vision we want. We want, we want, we want, we want, we want, we want, we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we discuss the making of a transnational capitalist class, corporate power, in the 21st century. We'll be joined for the first segment by Professor William Carroll to speak about his book on the topic of the transnational capitalist class. Later in the program, we're joined by journalist Sansara Taylor and activist Rafael Cadaris of RefuseFascism.org to talk about the growing resistance against the incoming Trump administration. Please stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, for the first segment, we're going to be talking about an ongoing theme that we've dealt with here on the program, and certainly a theme that has been researched and we've published about. Peter Phillips has written about the transnational capitalist class in the last several of the Project Censored books in varying degrees. And today we are going to be in conversation with William Carroll, who is an expert on the matter. And here is Peter to properly introduce our guest to you. Peter?
Bill Carroll is a professor of sociology at the University of Victoria, where he directs the Social Justice Studies program. His research interests are political economy of corporate capitalism, various social movements of social justice, and critical social theory. His most recent book is The Making of the Transnational Capitalist Class, and a recent article he wrote was Neoliberalism and the Transnational Capitalist Class. So, Bill, welcome.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
What is your definition or overall understanding of the transnational capitalist class?
There's a lot of discussion of that, you know, exactly how to bound the transnational capitalist class, who is in it and who isn't in it. For example, is Donald Trump a transnational capitalist? In some respects, he certainly is in terms of the reach of his investments, although they're sort of centered in the United States, they span beyond it. And that's often the case these days. And so it does depend on how you bound it. But my own research has really looked at the sort of what I call the leading edge of the transnational capitalist class. And those are the people who are really engaged in pretty high-level global corporate elite relations and practices. They might be involved in transnational policy groups, you know, like the World Economic Forum or the Trilateral Commission. But they sit on corporate boards, I guess, in terms of my, you know, just basic kind of nuts and bolts criterion for it. They would be sitting on multiple corporate boards that span across national borders. So they're involved in really transnational corporate business in a networked way at the top of the power structure as directors and executives of the largest corporations.
And these policy groups that these folks are involved in, like the International Chamber of Commerce, the Bilderberger, the Trilateral Commission, the World Economic Forum, are you saying then that those are setting global policies in terms of monetary policy or other agendas for various nation states?
They're definitely part of the policy planning process. There's no question that they have influence. It's not as if they dictate policy, but they have influence. And, of course, the influence is more than just the kind of policy positions that they're taking and communicating and to state officials and the lobbying processes and that kind of thing. But it's structurally underpinned by the power of the corporations themselves and the structural power of transnational capital, which is a power to invest or to divest, to move one's capital somewhere else, especially in an era of financialization, you know, where a lot of capital exists in financial form. So it's quite easy to move it around and to desert, let's say, a currency if a particular government moves too far from the neoliberal framework that's hegemonic globally these days. Although somewhat tattered, I would say, in some ways discredited by the crisis of 2008-2009, and yet sort of enjoying a kind of second life, you know, in a weird way through the various austerity programs that came in after all the bank bailouts and everything to sort of favor those bank bailouts. So it's a bit of a long-winded answer, but I think the policy groups definitely have influence. And, you know, if you look at some of these groups, they're quite strategic. For example, the Transatlantic Business Dialogue, which has a board comprised of, you know, the major transatlantic capitalists, basically. They shadow the international meetings of state leaders and so on and so forth in the North Atlantic region. And they prepare briefing papers that they submit before each summit and so on and so forth. So they're sort of, in a sense, in the background of the whole policy formation process.
Bill Carroll, Mickey Huff here. This is the Project Censored Show, Pacifica Radio. I have two questions, but one of them just came up because you mentioned the North Atlantic, and I couldn't help but think of NATO. And Peter Phillips has certainly written about the transnational capitalist class in terms of its connections to private military companies and contractors and these types of things. But how do you see any kind of relationship between this group of individuals and some of the powers of NATO and how that might help direct policy?
Definitely there are points of contact, informally at least. This isn't something I've really researched, but for example, the Bilderberg conferences generally involve transnational capitalists as well as various state officials. And the Bilderberg line has generally been pro-NATO, you know, from its inception in the early 50s. So it's sort of unscripted and undocumented elite discussion that takes place annually. And I'm sure that in those discussions, if we were flies on the wall or something, we'd probably hear people talking about strategic issues, including NATO. NATO is interesting, again, in terms of thinking about Trump and Trumpism, whatever that might turn out to be. It's a bit hard to say at this point. But, you know, he certainly created a certain panic, I think, among European elites in terms of some of his statements and posing up to Russia. So, you know, the kind of status quo geopolitical power arrangements are, I would say, distinct from the transnational capitalist class. But again, the class has influence in geopolitics and generally has an interest in open borders, open investment, political stability, which often means the use of force against local left movements and dissident groups and so on and so forth to try to really secure stable conditions for capital accumulation in various countries throughout the world.
Well, and that surely goes back to at least Smedley Butler, going way back, up to 100 years even, but certainly in the first few decades of the 20th century. That leads to the second part of what I wanted to ask you about. But I wanted to know if you could somehow maybe encapsulate or give listeners kind of a brief history of the rise of what you are calling the transnational capitalist class.
My research is really sort of looking at the leading edge or the top tier of the transnational capitalist class. I mean, capitalism has been sort of transnational and kind of a globalizing force for, you know, five centuries. But you can begin to trace these power structures coming into being and being consolidated in the 20th century and progressively more so in the post-World War II era, where you really have under American leadership or hegemony a global economy opening up under the U.S. open-door policy. And so that the former structure, if you like, of imperialism, which involved competing states and states trying to secure spheres of influence through colonization processes or things resembling that, that begins to break down, and instead you get development over a long period of time from the 40s into the 70s and 80s of this less and less enclosed world in the sense of political borders to capital mobility. And with that, you have transnational corporations, of course, developing an increasingly internationalized financial system. And at the top of that power structure, you have the executives and directors of those largest corporations and financial institutions. And as they're investing more and more globally, they begin to cohere into a transnational corporate elite. My colleague Meindert Venema really did the path-breaking work on this sociologically in terms of networks of the transnational capitalist class in the early 1970s. He was able to trace it at that point. But basically, the structure has been very, very much Euro-North American in terms of the major participants and the way the network of elite relations, these capitalists who are sort of sitting on each other's boards, that is really a structure that is very strongly developed in Europe and North America, and the whole EU integration process has actually deepened that process in Europe. But the rest of the world is rather peripheral to the network. So Japan has some connections into the transnational corporate elite network, but not that many. And the global south is largely out of the picture. But in the past 20 years, there has been some increase in that, you know, with the development of so-called BRICS and so on, the high rates of capital accumulation, and very large corporations developing in countries like Brazil, obviously China, India, that these corporate directors and executives of the really large corporations in the global south are beginning to hook into the transnational corporate elite, but they still occupy quite a marginal position compared to the European and North American capitalists.
Bill Carroll, you have done research showing the interlocks of major corporations, particularly in Canada, but also around the world. And one of the things since the financial crisis of 2007 and 8, you say there's been a thinning, so to speak, of interlocks between major corporations worldwide. Does that play into the further establishment of these policy groups and the Trilateral Commission and these others that kind of cement opportunities for corporations and corporate CEOs to talk to each other?
Yeah, I do think so. I think the policy groups have been proliferating, and that policy, that corporate policy group elite network is a very important apparatus, if you like. Again, informal. It's not as if it's there's someone formally directing all of this. It's really a matter of sort of powerful people being recruited to the boards of these policy groups because they are powerful people and they have connections and insights about how the world works and so on and so forth. But what we end up with is a pretty dense network of corporate executives and directors who are connected through their participation in the transnational policy groups. And then at the same time, there has been a thinning of the interlocks among corporations themselves. This is an uneven process, but in some countries, these corporate elite networks have thinned quite dramatically. Japan would be an example of that. And it has to do with a number of factors. One of the main ones is corporate governance reforms coming out of various financial scandals in the 1980s and into the 1990s, so that by the mid-1990s, the OECD, for example, had adopted best practice guidelines for how corporate boards should be structured and trying to basically rein in the tendency toward a kind of very hierarchical, closed kind of old boys club. And trying to make boards more efficient so that they could be better generators of corporate profit by making the boards smaller and limiting the involvement of corporate directors on other boards. So there's still plenty of interlocking happening, but it's at a lower rate than it used to be before some of these governance reforms came in.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're in conversation with Professor Bill Carroll. The topic is the transnational capitalist class.
Bill, I would like you to talk about neoliberalism and how that seems to be a continuing core philosophy for the transnational capitalist class.
Neoliberalism really has a long history, a deeper history than we often think. We often identify it with Margaret Thatcher, which is fair enough in terms of the political mobilization of neoliberalism in the 1970s in the global north. But we can take it back to Augusto Pinochet and the coup in Chile in 1973, because really Pinochet implemented the first neoliberal project. And before that, there was the development of neoliberal thinking and policy frameworks within the Mont Pelerin Society beginning in the 1940s, led by the famous economist philosopher Hayek. And really, from Hayek's writings forward, neoliberalism through Milton Friedman and so on and so forth involves a kind of policy framework, if you like, that recognizes capital as the source of wealth and growth and prosperity, and states are burdens upon capital. Basically, the philosophy is one of trying to free investment to basically seek the highest profits in unregulated markets, trying to privatize public assets because public assets are, again, a drain on wealth creation. And so it's a philosophy that really centers the world around the market. But of course, in our era, which is an era of very large corporations, not free competition, when you do that, what you're actually doing is accentuating corporate power. So the more capital is deregulated, the more public assets are privatized and so on and so forth, which are basic to neoliberalism as a framework, the greater the power of capitalists and especially the capitalists that control the really major corporations and financial institutions, the more power they have, you know, to move things around, to make the decisions that they think will maximize their profits. And I guess in my view, the problem with neoliberalism is that it doesn't recognize the way in which capital is actually a parasitic phenomenon in the sense that it really is generated out of people's work. And so the labor that people are doing in factories or in the service sector, whatever, gets turned into capital and turned into profit, some of which goes back to workers as wages. The basic system is one of accumulating private wealth in the hands of a very small class of people. And neoliberalism is really, in that sense, I would agree with David Harvey, that it's very much a part of class warfare. It's a kind of reassertion of the power of capital in everyday life, in the public sphere, in the private sphere, and certainly vis-a-vis the state.
Certainly, Bill, you have written about the Atlas Economic Research Foundation, which supports and is closely involved with over 400 think tanks worldwide that support neoliberal policies. That's a massive network, and huge amounts of money go into that. They, of course, influence the media and push that agenda. Do you see Donald Trump with his sort of neoliberal privatization policies supporting this globally, or is he more going to be more in isolating the United States economically?
I think Trump is a very interesting phenomenon. I mean, when Thatcher came to power in the 70s and through the 80s when she was in power and really effecting the transformations that became neoliberalism and were generalized beyond Britain, of course, you know, and Reagan was doing the same thing at the same time. When all of that happened, you know, a term that came into parlance, at least among academics, is authoritarian populism. And, you know, I think Thatcher certainly was an authoritarian populist, but in a sense, Donald Trump takes that to a new level in terms of the combination of a kind of white nationalism that is in some ways in tension with neoliberalism, at least they say Hillary Clinton-style neoliberalism. And on the other hand, he is himself a well-placed billionaire capitalist with all sorts of investments and so on and so forth, and certainly is a neoliberal in a very basic sense that he believes in the logic of capital. So, for example, his public works program is going to be a kind of program that privileges corporations and is, to some extent, might be a kind of crony capitalist operation. It's hard to say at this point. We do, you know, he's not yet president. But in any case, he is, I think, in some ways a neoliberal, and in some ways his nationalism runs against the grain of neoliberalism, which is why right now there's so much questioning and tension, I think, around the Trump phenomenon and what it might mean for what has been a fairly settled neoliberal hegemony in the world, despite the 2008 financial crisis that I mentioned earlier.
Bill Carroll, taking a look at some of the characters that have begun populating the incoming Trump administration, these are pretty establishment characters, however. I mean, certainly we could riff on the authoritarian populism. That was certainly a component to the campaigning and the rhetoric that we saw here in the U.S. But what about the actual people that are being put in cabinet positions? I mean, these are Wall Street insiders. You mentioned crony capitalism. In many ways, is this not business as usual?
I agree. I think it's hard to read at this point, I would say. Like, his cabinet is looks to me like a combination of a corporate boardroom and a military junta.
Sounds like fascism.
But I think the people in the cabinet, a lot of them are pretty mainstream people who knows if Hillary Clinton, she actually did win the election, but, you know, if she were the president-elect assembling a cabinet, she might have chosen some of the same people.
Well, yes, that's the issue, right? Right,
which is
back to business as usual. For neoliberalism, at any rate. What do you see in the strain here, maybe, that is a shot across the bow of neoliberalism outside of ire and angst in the electorate? You know, we don't have time to bring Brexit and all these other things into the discussion, perhaps. But I mean, what are some signals you see here what might be different in Trump?
Well, I think the signals so far have been sort of tweets, and maybe
okay,
that will continue
right
through his term in office. But, you know, and things, you know, and how much of this was prearranged or exactly how it took place, we don't really know. But for example, the pressure put on Ford to invest in the United States and to, in effect, divest or not do a project in Mexico that it was planning to do. It's, I think the idea of scrapping NAFTA, I mean, I don't think NAFTA will be scrapped, but the renegotiation, which could happen, that I think certainly has people, the neoliberals, concerned, because NAFTA is sort of the, you know, it's the template for what so much has happened in terms of these investor rights agreements. I agree with you. I don't think we're looking at a massive shift with Trump, except that I think he does have this authoritarian populist or semi-fascist, however we want to describe it, aspect to his thinking and his politics. And we just have to wait and see how that plays out, I guess. But some of the cabinet appointments and some of his advisors, like his chief advisor, are really far-right activists. And that's a bit different.
Certainly the idea of the final conclusion of the New Deal seems to be part of this administration's focus, and whether or not they can take Social Security and privatize it. And the safety net programs essentially eliminate or weed down to very, very low levels. That authoritarian populism, combined with the negations of ethnic groups, Muslims and immigrants, really does speak to a strong fascism agenda that, I mean, when we go to the AFL definition of fascism, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think it's always tricky, you know, that F word, you know, what is fascism?
Right. In terms of political science, not in terms of Nazism and so forth.
The aspect of it that I see as particularly fascist is the tendency, I think, in Trump from the beginning of his campaigning to really not be interested in open political discussion, debate of issues. I think his approach is that of a kind of very powerful corporate executive, and I think that's how he will run the state, to the extent that the president runs the state, which is, you know, definitely has considerable power. And I think there is a kind of fascism in that, you know, a kind of commitment to the regnant goals of capital and of business. I'm not sure what he's going to end up in terms of the labor front. Like, he's got a labor secretary who is basically opposed to minimum wages. You know, I mean, I think part of fascism is a kind of attack on labor typically, and on democratic rights, on minority groups, as you mentioned. And so, you know, we can see that in Trump. And I guess we just have to wait and see and figure out how to resist the actual policies that might come forward under that flag.
Bill Carroll, we're going to wrap up here pretty quick, and I just really want you to talk about the transnational capitalist class and its agenda for the world, the privatization and the free flow of capital anywhere in the world. And I really have to think of the American military empire and NATO as in support of that agenda. So capital seeks its own places for return, and that is an ongoing agreement. Could you comment a little bit on that?
Well, yeah, I think ever since, you know, again, the original neoliberal project of Thatcherism, neoliberalism has always relied on a strong state to secure the conditions for the so-called free market, for, you know, for capital, investor rights and mobility and so on and so forth. So I think that translates also at the international level to the need for strong militaristic and state back up to the power of corporations themselves. And I don't see that changing, certainly. I think that is the trajectory of the transnational capitalist class. If it's going to change, it will be pressure from below through democratic movements that seek alternatives to corporate power globally and locally. But I think neoliberalism, as I've mentioned, is in some ways rather discredited, and yet there isn't any strong alternative that's been presented successfully, although I think Bernie Sanders, you know, with his kind of social democratic vision, was very important and very instructive to see how much traction that got among the American public, and similarly in Britain with Jeremy Corbyn. So, you know, we can see opposition to neoliberalism, the pink tide in Latin America and so on and so forth, developments in South Africa. But I think we've got a real uphill struggle in the sense of how entrenched that both power of capital and power of the state and, as you say, the U.S. military, but also the broader kind of global governance framework that's come in as part of neoliberalism.
We've been talking today about the transnational capitalist class. We've been joined by Professor of Sociology at the University of Victoria, Bill Carroll. The book we've been discussing is called The Making of a Transnational Capitalist Class, Corporate Power in the 21st Century. Bill Carroll, thanks so much for taking time out to join the Project Censored show today.
Oh, you're most welcome.
After this musical break, we'll be back to talk about the incoming Trump administration and resistance growing towards it. Please stay with us.
See, I gotta draw a line, I can't take it no more. If you ain't down with revolution, what you waiting for? Making money for suckers and not communities poor. Ripping flags off of coffers, man, this ain't our war. Colonized and terrorized by the world's biggest killers. The U.S. government, the biggest weapon and drug dealers. Filling prisons with children, incarcerating the future. MySpace and Facebook got us stuck on computers. Stuck on stupid bumping music that's abusive to the shorties. And the nonsense that you're spitting, they just listening, absorbing. I've been dormant, I've been...
Welcome back to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On the first part of the program today, we were speaking with Professor Bill Carroll, and we were speaking about the rise of the transnational capitalist class. During that conversation, we were talking about President-elected Trump and the incoming administration, and we also mentioned crony capitalism, and in fact, even a politically scientific conversation about fascism emerged from that conversation. And in this segment of the program, we're going to focus more specifically on the F word there, and we're joined by two guests. Our first guest is journalist Sansara Taylor. She writes with Revcom.us. She is also one of the co-initiators of RefuseFascism.org. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. So we'll be speaking with Sansara Taylor about this latest action that's featured also in the New York Times. And here is Peter Phillips to introduce our other guests for this segment. Peter?
Rafael Vadarius, he's an organizer with RefugeFascism.org. And he's part of the Revolution Club. And he was one of the people, 16 people, who was arrested at the Republican National Convention for obstructing official business. They also burned a flag, but they've not been charged with that. So welcome, Sansara and Rafael.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be with you, Peter and Mickey.
Well, Sansara Taylor, let's start. You're one of the co-initiators of RefuseFascism.org. Tell us, how did this come about?
Well, our basic message is, like you said, it's in the name of humanity. We refuse to accept a fascist America. And this came about because myself and others, we were looking at that a lot of people didn't expect Trump and Pence to win the election. And if you really want to count the numbers, they lost by almost 3 million votes, but they won the Electoral College. So they're slated to become president in the next regime. A lot of people didn't expect that. But once that became the case, we had to really confront these people are fascists. It's not they campaigned on a platform of shredding constitutional rights, of bragging about sexual assault of women, combined with a theocratic program of criminalizing and birth control and abortion, shaming gay people, promoting conversion reparative therapy for gay people, threats of nuclear escalation and nuclear arms race, white supremacy, open, unbridled elevating of neo-Nazis and white supremacy in a way that has not happened in decades. Everything they campaigned on, everything that they've done since they were elected, including the cabinet they're building, and everything they intend to carry through on is a fascist program, and it's one that has to be stopped before it starts. You can't allow people like this to get their hands on the full machinery of the state, the organs of repression, the nuclear arsenal, Guantanamo Bay. He's bragging about torture and he wants to pack Guantanamo with, quote, bad dudes. Once they come to power, it's immeasurably more difficult to resist. It's immeasurably more damage that is done to humanity and the planet. And so there's an urgent window that we have to seize. Before they come to power, we have to rapidly transform the agony, the anguish, the anger, the terror that is felt by tens of millions in the wake of this election, who are horrified by what they see in Trump and Pence and their cabinet of ghouls, to translate that right now into organized massive resistance in the streets to such a degree, not stopping, not going home, flooding D.C., flooding the streets of every major city and small town, and not leaving until we create such a political crisis that these people cannot consolidate their hands on the reins of power in this country.
In fact, Sansara Taylor at RefuseFascism.org, you have a link to The Call, and it talks about a month of resistance starting on the day the Electoral College met, which was December 19th. Could you talk a little bit about that and what has been going on maybe since December 19 and what is coming up here in January?
Yeah, well, we kicked off on the 19th with mass organizing meetings in New York and other parts of the country, and we brought people together. All this has come together on an emergency footing, a very rapid basis, and it needs to escalate on an emergency footing. And everybody listening has a big role and responsibility to play in that. But we kicked off on December 19th, and then we've been organizing since then. We did protests around the country on New Year's Eve saying no, no fascist 2017, no fascist USA. We did them in New York, in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, in Chicago, and other places around the country. And we put a full-page ad in the New York Times that says no, it's huge, no, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. Stop Trump and Pence before they start. And it lays out both the indictment of the crimes and the danger of this regime and why we call it fascist and why it is correct to do so, but also details, as you said, the month of resistance, calling for people to step forward out of their routine, out of their daily lives, and disrupt the normal. And what we are doing right now is we're January 14th, MLK weekend, starting now and building towards this, we are calling on people to flood D.C. We're sending an advance contingent down in a couple of days. We're calling protests in parts of the country all over, but especially January 14th and going forward, we're calling for people to occupy public space, to come to D.C. or to occupy public space wherever you are and to stay in the streets, not leave, call more people forward. Our contention is this. It's twofold. One, really, we have a historic imperative, a moral imperative to stop a global catastrophe, which is what the Trump-Pence regime will be. And I'm not saying this because ignorant to the fact that there have been crimes. There have been crimes perpetrated by U.S. imperialism. There's been the police murder of black and brown people. There's been violence against women. There's been drone strikes and terror around the world. It's not new. But Trump and Pence are going to put all this on steroids, and they are going to, they have a program to crush and terrorize opposition and dissent. And we have a moral imperative to stop them before they start. And two, because they are so extreme, because they are so determined to shred what have been norms and standards, at least pretenses of basic rights that have been enshrined in the Constitution, they're willing to shred all that. And they've posed such an open threat to so many people, black people, women, immigrants, Muslims, the planet. There are so many people who are disturbed. There's an unprecedented number of people who are deeply disturbed that if we get out there and we act boldly, we need to call them forward. We become a force that others can rally around and join with. And this needs to happen. It has to happen fast. And there's a basis for that. And that is what we're fighting for.
Sansara and Rafael, I think it's important that in this big ad you took out is that you're not saying Trump is a Hitler. You're not saying Trump is Mussolini. Nazism was one form of fascism, but fascism has deep traditional roots that are nationalistic, often identify an enemy that riles up the people like immigrants and Muslims now. It's very emotional based, so it's not coming from the Enlightenment or academic sources, but really feelings about what people want. And so it can even include science denial or academic denial. And it's really a popular authoritarianism, so a strong authoritarian leader. Is that a broader understanding of what you mean by fascism?
In the statement that we published in the New York Times, we made the point that after detailing the Trump-Pence program, we said, by any definition, this is fascism. And I know there are several different major definitions that people have put forward, different scholars, different historians, and a lot of them have the qualities that you're describing. I would add to that the open, dictatorial, terroristic rule of the capitalist class. I don't think that this is something other than capitalism, imperialism, but it is a different form, a qualitatively more openly dictatorial, where even the pretenses of basic rights to speech and assembly and dissent are curtailed, if not completely shredded, where there is also the fomenting and unleashing of fascist social movements, terroristic social movements that carry out extra legal terror that go along with the state-sponsored terror. And you see this in the kinds of things like Donald Trump sends a tweet that threatens a union leader, a mid-level, not a particularly major representative union leader in a Midwestern state, and all of a sudden he's getting death threats, his wife is getting rape threats. He's unleashed a Twitter lynch mob. So you have both from on high the promise to shred constitutional protected speech, like the threat to strip citizenship from people who burn the American flag, like Raphael and others.
We had Joey Johnson on not long ago.
Yeah, and Joey Johnson, the threat from the state to shred those rights and the unleashing of a mob from below to carry out that terror and to chill. And this is why it has to be stopped before it starts, because it's not an incremental worsening of the crimes this country has been guilty of. It is a qualitative leap where the space to fight it is taken away through terror. And that's a big part of fascism. We did say in this that by any definition, Trump and Pence are a fascist regime, because we didn't want to get into a big dispute over the definition. We wanted to confront the reality that we're facing. But I think it's important for people to understand this.
Let's go over to Rafael here and have you talk about what events are planned nationally and in the Bay Area.
I was just going to add one thing to the last discussion about fascism, that with the Trump regime, you do have this coalition between open sexual predator, you know, who talks about molesting women, right, and walking in on girls in the locker room and stuff, with what can only be called Christian fascism of Mike Pence and Steve Bannon, people who advocate the, you know, inherent superiority of Western Christian civilization. And Mike Pence wants to ban abortion under all circumstances, including rape and health of the woman. Mike Pence believes in banning contraception. Mike Pence believes in torturing gay children. Sansara was referencing this conversion therapy, torturing gay children. There's actually a woman in Indiana who is still in prison for having a miscarriage under Mike Pence's governorship in Indiana. So this is someone, Jeremy Scahill, called Mike Pence a Christian jihadist. This is another terrifying aspect of this Trump-Pence regime, is the stripping away of the separation of church and state and the imposition of a theocratic rule. That's another dimension of why it's absolutely correct to call these people fascists. And like, I think there was a famous quote from someone where they said that when fascism comes to America, it'll be wrapped in a flag and carrying a cross.
Yeah, Sinclair Lewis.
Sinclair Lewis. This is a particular form of it, although they are also uniting with the traditional. Steve Bannon has direct ties to the neo-Nazi movement. There's cyber lynch mobs. They've given a platform to the so-called alt-right, which is directly connected to neo-Nazis. Jeff Sessions, the nominee for attorney general, says the only thing that's wrong with the Ku Klux Klan is that some of them smoke marijuana. I mean, KKK sympathizers, neo-Nazi sympathizers, these people are going to be in the White House now.
So, Rafael Carderas, let's back up a moment. We're still joined by Sansara Taylor, who writes with Revolution Newspaper, is also one of the co-initiators of the call for refusefascism.org, along with Carl Dix, Henry Giroux, Cornel West. I wanted to back up for a moment. Rafael Carderas, could you talk to us a little bit about, you know, your involvement with refusefascism.org and a little bit about, well, how did you end up in this movement right now?
The Revolution Club, as Peter mentioned, we were actually out in front of the Republican National Convention this summer in Cleveland. And our message was, Donald Trump was saying, make America great again. Hillary Clinton was saying, America's already great. And our message was, no, America's was never great. And we need to overthrow this system, not vote for it. But at the same time, we understood, look, Trump is an unprecedented fascist threat to humanity and to the planet. We haven't been really talking about it yet, but, you know, he's appointed a whole cabinet full of climate deniers, fossil fuel industry executives. This is an extreme danger to humanity and the climate. So when Trump was elected, we did have to confront that, and we had to confront that reality and act accordingly. And, you know, I am a student of history. I was a history major in college. My family and my grandparents got to this country, but the rest of them died in the Holocaust. And the lesson from that whole experience is never again for anybody. And the way that Trump is talking about Muslims, replace the word Muslim with the word Jew and see how much they sound like Nazis. So I was excited to see the development and all the initiators, Cornel West, Carl Dix. Since then, there have been important protests here in the Bay Area. 150, 200 people marched down Market Street straight into the crowds on New Year's Eve, watching the fireworks, and brought this message, no, we refuse to accept a fascist America. Make this your New Year's resolution, that in 2017, we're going to do everything we can to resist, to fight, to stop this fascist regime before it starts. This Saturday, I want to let everyone know that at the Twitter headquarters, we've been talking about some of Trump's tweets, threatening nuclear war against the world, going after union leaders and whipping up cyber lynch mobs, threatening to take away the citizenship rights of people who, you know, exercise their First Amendment constitutional rights to burn the American flag, like me, and something that not only affects us, but will chill dissent throughout the country if that's allowed to become the legal precedent. There's going to be a protest at the Twitter headquarters, and this is extremely important. You know, we should have the same spirit of those NAACP leaders that did a sit-in in the Attorney General Jeff Sessions, the nominee in his office in Alabama, and said either he has to withdraw his nomination or they're going to have to take us out in handcuffs.
What's the message to Twitter, Rafael Carderas?
That they need to shut down Trump's Twitter account. I mean, this is
something. So you're advocating that they censor Trump? Well, I mean, I'm going to play devil's advocate for a moment because this is the Project Censored show. I'm just saying that's a slippery slope there if you're going to start censoring. That's what I wanted to try to find out here. I mean, obviously we could see that if Twitter is a vehicle for hate speech or these types of things, that's why I'm trying to get some clarification here, just because, you know, there are many other efforts on the right to silence and censor people, including yourself for burning the flag. So I just wanted to have a maybe a more specific statement from you on that. And Sansara, feel free to jump in.
Yeah, I guess my feeling on this, I think there's a really sound and solid argument that people have been bringing forward about why Trump, who has knowingly whipped up and unleashed lynch mob violence at his rallies, he's offered to defend people who you know, incur legal fees for assaulting protesters. He's gotten out there. He's said publicly, I wish I could punch these people in the face. He's boasted about all this. And then he's knowingly unleashed a hate lynch mob through his Twitter feed,
which is arguably not protected speech.
Which is arguably, thank you for that, not protected speech, and which also Twitter has the discretion and policy. I think there's a valid argument to be made, and I know that people have been raising this and targeting the Twitter headquarters, and I wish them more and more people joining them. But I will say the bigger message for our part in what we're doing is not so much that this institution or that institution needs to stop publicizing Donald Trump. It's that the masses of people in this country need to step forward and stop thinking something else is going to stop this fascist program, some check or balance which is being ripped up, or some politician, all of whom are capitulating. It's going to be on us. So my feeling is, one, that there's a very strong argument to be made why Twitter should withdraw his feed. But even more fundamentally, I'm for fanning every outpouring of opposition and calling everybody forward in the streets in a multitude of diverse ways to stop this regime. So I guess I think it's a bigger issue than even his Twitter feed.
Indeed, it is. And you kind of put it into context that way. We're speaking with Sansara Taylor, also Rafael Cadaris of RefuseFascism.org. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America is one of the mantras, and many initiators have formed this, not just a statement that's been published in the New York Times, among other places, but it's also a vision for stopping this incoming administration with their far-right agenda. And Rafael Cadaris, let's go with you with that. A little bit of historical vision, but also, what are some things that are happening? What are some ways in which people can resist what's coming with the Trump administration?
Well, the mission of RefuseFascism.org is actually to create such a political crisis in this country that this regime is actually prevented from ruling. And the only way that's going to happen is not by, you know, relying on someone in the Democratic Party to be the savior, right, who's going to stop this Trump regime. The only way that's going to happen is through mass defiant resistance from below. We're talking about millions, tens of millions of people need to come out in the streets. They need to flood D.C. They need to shut down and disrupt business as usual all over the country, but especially in D.C. I'm going to D.C. soon to bring this message of no, like, we're not going to accept this. And this has happened before in other countries, right? In Egypt in 2011, millions of people took to the streets. They drove out the hated tyrant, Hosni Mubarak. Just recently, millions of people came out night after night in South Korea and actually forced the impeachment of the president of South Korea. And now they're saying, well, we don't just want an impeachment. We want her to driven out immediately. So they're continuing to come out in the streets. This is the type of thing that we need. And there is a basis to do this. You know, there is the mass sentiment that Sansara talked about, the mass sentiment, the anguish, the depression, the disgust, all the people that are terrified about the prospects of the Trump world that he wants to create. All that mass sentiment needs to be turned into mass resistance. But there's also been unprecedented protests and resistance that has begun from the night the election happened and all the walk due to the college walkouts, the high school walkouts that happened all over the country. There's the musicians that are refusing to play at the inauguration. There are the MIT professors and the Notre Dame professors that are denouncing the Trump administration, the climate scientists that are refusing to turn over their information.
The Mormons.
We want to fan the flames, like Sansara was saying, of all of this resistance all over the country, but increasingly, it needs to be directed towards actually preventing this regime from taking power. It can't just be a dynamic of registering our opposition and opposing the Trump regime once they start doing all these things that they've promised to do, because by that time it could become too late. And I understand the sentiment of people saying, okay, when they come for the Muslims, I'll hide the Muslims in my attic like Anne Frank. But we can't allow it to get to that point. So we need to go all out right now to actually stop this regime. Come to D.C., wherever you are, disrupt business as usual. Don't wait. Do it now.
I would like to ask a little bit about how fascist tendencies have been emerging in the U.S., both under the Bush administration and Obama, whereby we're handing the Trump administration, the folks there, a permanent war, which is one major element of fascism, expanded authoritarianism, a militarized police in the country, killing up to 1,200 people this year, a continuing Homeland Security Agency and Patriot Act that has suspended habeas corpus on the will of the president and allows for literally martial law at any point to be declared if there's unrest. So all the laws, many of the laws are in place that Trump can utilize. It's not like he has to recreate all of this. It's already there. And so his fascist tendencies, popular authoritarianism, will feed to that. And so I think the calling that you're making, it sounds very important. Do you agree with that assessment?
I would say that it's a really important dimension that you're bringing in. I do agree. I mean, people, they get on our case because we talk about, look, there's an analogy to be made to the Nazis, or there's an analogy to be made to Chile under Pinochet, that we're looking at a fascist regime, and they say, oh, it's not the same, it's not the same. And it's true. History never repeats itself exactly. But here I would say, given what you're describing, when Hitler came to power, he didn't have the Patriot Act, nuclear weapons, already dragnet spying on everybody's personal correspondences and emails and phone calls. He didn't have, like you're saying, a militarized police. There's a level of repressive apparatus in this country right now, which is already historically unrivaled and unprecedented. It was built up in waves and stages and leaps along the way. A big leap came after 9/11 when George W. Bush implemented the Patriot Act, and there was a whole watch what you say and a chill, and they started the hunt and the watch list against academics and others. There's the enemy combatant status. There's Guantanamo. There's indefinite detention. All these things have been built up. And in many ways, Obama has expanded executive privilege and authority and stripped the so-called checks and balances even further. And one thing that's almost completely unknown, people are aware of the Supreme Court vacancy that Trump is going to fill if he's allowed in office. But there's about 30% of the federal court judgeships are empty because the Republican Congress blocked Obama along the way so much. And so if Trump is allowed in, he'll appoint all those judges. There'll be even more of a fascist court system, which is even weaker up against the presidential executive authority because of what Obama has helped do. So I would argue that all this makes it immeasurably more dangerous, because Trump would be coming in to a system and an organization of the state which has already far exceeded any repressive apparatus that has existed, you know, anywhere else that something like this is happening. So I don't say this to scare people. I say this because it's true. I also think even with this, we have a window. This underscores why we have to seize this window. We have 2 weeks before they have their hands on power. What happened in Egypt that Rafael was describing, that happened rapidly. It happened rapidly because people had daring and they went out in the streets. They had it right on their side. And it was at a moment of political and geopolitical shockwaves. There were big changes going on in the world. Well, this election and looming fascist regime is a huge shockwave. It's hit millions of people. And there's the basis now, an unprecedented basis that didn't exist in the same way under Obama or under Bush, to call those people forward right now, rapidly. But it depends on each of us acting with everything we've got. Because right now, if we go in the streets, and this is what refusefascism.org is calling for and organizing, and people can get involved in a multitude of ways, but in the streets, in your professions, in your communities, in your congregations, with your money and your resources, with your voice and your social media, in many different ways, to call people forward into public spaces to resist, to protest, to do it and to grow very rapidly, and to do it on such a scale literally millions and tens of millions in the next 2 weeks. It's the crisis from below, and it's the crisis among the rulers, where there's people with big differences with Trump who are in the halls of power, but right now they're all cowed and going along. We have to from below create such demand that those differences open up, and all of a sudden the multitude of things, which any one of which could be a scandal that could bring this president down, this president-elect down, any one of which, but none of which will unless there's a mass demand. That's the mechanism through, and precisely for the reasons that you're describing, the amount of unprecedented repressive and terroristic power that he will be inheriting, and that he has proven not only a willingness but an eagerness to use against people. This demands that we act now.
Well, certainly what's being inherited from Obama includes drone assassinations and a deportation mechanism that's already doing 400,000 people a year. So we're seeing a continuation of policies, but in all likelihood, a big expansion and a process of very emotional populism that denies science. So combine that together. Rafael, talk about that a little bit.
Well, yeah, I mean, Obama deported more people than any president before him, but Trump has said he wants to deport all 11 million undocumented immigrants, and even in the first year, he's threatened to deport 3 or 4 million. He's called Mexicans rapists. You know, he whipped his whole campaign. He had people chanting, "Build the wall." So I think this is a good example. The answer, from my perspective, the answer to Trump is not to go back to the status quo, because the status quo was a reign of terror for immigrants, for black people, for women, for LGBT people, for people around the world who are on the receiving end of those drone strikes. But this will be a reign of terror on top of a reign of terror if this Trump regime gets into power. And like Sansara said, resistance is the order of the day, and we all have to get organized right now. We have 2 or 3 weeks. We have a window to stop this regime before they actually take the reins of that state power that you're describing. Organize your friends, organize your community, organize your church, organize your schools. Students should be walking out January 12th and 13th. There's a call for nationwide student walkouts. Come to D.C. Be there by January 14th. The whole week leading up to the inauguration needs to be occupying public spaces, disrupting business as usual, being a lightning rod that calls, you know, grows from hundreds to thousands to millions in the next couple weeks.
Well, from the Rockettes to the Mormon Tabernacle Choir to, you know, some, you know, higher profile sport type celebrities to members of even the leadership of the Republican Party to liberal slash progressives like Robert Reich, Ajamu Baraka, right? Not long ago wrote a piece, Counterpunch, on this about neo-fascism. I mean, Baraka's using this terminology himself. And even Robert Reich, of all people, is trying to you know, call out and warning signs of tyranny and so forth. So this is not just something that's coming from the so-called far left, right, as we'll hear, and we certainly will hear corporate media frame it as some kind of fringe resistance to the Trump movement. But by any cursory survey, it's much more vast than that. It's broader than that kind of resistance. And we're certainly seeing a core of the message here with Sansara Taylor, with Rafael Kaderis. And the website is, once again, please tell us, Rafael?
RefuseFascism.org.
Right. And Sansara Taylor, any last words from you for this segment?
I think that what you just described is really true. We've been talking about the unprecedented dangers of this regime and the need to stop it now, which everybody needs to look at themselves in the mirror and think about, what are you going to do when this is rising here? But the other thing that you were just mentioning, the unprecedented outpourings of opposition, these are indicators of the basis to stop this regime. The Rockettes disaffecting from performing at the inauguration. That's a deep thing. Anthony Bourdain refusing to eat in the Trump hotels because he says he doesn't look good in a brown shirt, referring to the brown shirts in Nazi Germany. There's a multitude of examples. You gave some of them. It's very important. But I would pose this too. These are indicators, and they're beautiful, and we should take heart in them. But really, we have to stop this regime. And so everything that has come forward so far needs to be built on, and it has to become not just registering our opposition, as righteous as and important as that is, but stopping this regime. Out in the streets, refusing to leave day after day, night after night. Go to the website refusefascism.org. Come to Washington, D.C. starting January 14th and do not leave. Quit your job. Take off from school. Be there and bring everybody you know or come by yourself. And if you really cannot make it, then occupy some space where you are. Be out there with a big sign that says no. Put out the website refusefascism.org. Gather others with you. This is a moment for tremendous courage, for tremendous daring, for being completely unconciliatory and uncompromising and demanding the same of everybody else who does not want to accept a fascist America in the name of humanity.
Sansara
Taylor,
this
is a moment that we have to fight. Thank you so much.
Sansara Taylor and Rafael Cadaris, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show today.
Great to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
That does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Special thanks to our guest today. Bill Carroll joined us to talk about the transnational capitalist class, and we were joined by Sansara Taylor and Rafael Cadaris to talk about refusefascism.org. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. The Project Censored Show airs on nearly 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. Special thanks to Anthony Fest, our producer, Erica Bridgman, our engineer. Please follow us and like us on Facebook and learn more about our work at projectcensored.org. We'll see you next time.
Habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, far for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. And the times for the master thief, confine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu.
We got that love.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Next Level, a benefit dance party on Saturday, January 21st, after the Women's March, starting at 8 p.m. at the Jade Club in Portland. This 21 and over event features Jen O of Strange Babes, KABU's DJ Anjali, and Casual Aztec, as well as performance